Peter, consider the seed of a lotus plant. It can still germinate after 1,300 years. Bacterial spores have been discovered in bee amber, perfectly preserved and viable after tens of millions of years. And recently, scientists from Westchester University successfully revived bacteria that had been trapped for 250 million years inside salt crystals, deep underground. Quantum physics seems to hint at the possibility of time travel, and while intriguing, those are theories that only apply to particles on the subatomic level. Real time travel doesn't need wormholes or flux capacitors. Chuckles rippled through the auditorium. That line always sparked a laugh. He smiled out at all those faces he couldn't see, like they weren't even there. Nothing but the crowd energy and the lights and the heat of the lights. He said, "Real-time travel is already here. Has been for eons, occurring in nature, and that's where we, as scientists, must look." It was a 40-minute presentation, and for the duration his mind was elsewhere, in the tiny town of Wayward Pines, Idaho, that was more and more feeling like home. With his collector, Javier, who had promised to deliver 10 new recruits by year's end. With the last phase of his research and the pending sale to the military, which would fully fund everything to come. When he'd finished, he took questions, people lining up behind a microphone, positioned at the front of the center aisle. The fourth question came from a biology student with long black hair. It was the inevitable question that had come at some point during every one of his lectures. She said, "Thanks so much for coming, Dr. Pilcher. It's been a real privilege to have you on campus these last few days. Pleasure's all mine. You've talked a lot about medical applications for suspended animation, using it to keep trauma patients in stasis until proper care can be administered. But what about what you alluded to at the beginning of your talk?" "You mean time travel?" David said. "The fun stuff?" "Exactly." "Well, I was just trying to get your attention." Everyone laughed. "It worked," the student said. "You're asking if I think it's possible?" "Yes." He took off his glasses, set them down on his leather notepad. "Well, it's certainly fun to dream about, isn't it?" he said. "Look, there have been successful tests on mice, deanimating them by initiating hypothermia, but as you can imagine, getting human test subjects to sign up for such an experiment is a whole other matter, especially long-term dormancy. Is it possible?" "Yes, I think so. But we're still decades away. For now, I'm afraid, suspended animation as a time travel application for humanity is the stuff of bad science fiction." They were still clapping as he walked off stage. The young overachieving escort who'd been at his side during his entire stay on campus was waiting in the wings with a blinding smile. "That was so amazing, Dr. Pilcher. Oh my God, I'm so inspired. Thank you, Amber. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Would you mind showing me to the nearest exit?" "What about your book signing? I need a breath of fresh air first." She led him through the backstage corridors, past dressing rooms, to a pair of doors in the back of the building next to a loading bay. "Is everything okay, Dr. Pilcher?" she asked. "Of course. And you'll be right back? They're already lining up at your signing table. I have a book for you to sign, too." "Wouldn't miss it." David pushed through the double doors and stepped out into the alley. The darkness and the quiet and the cold so welcome. The nearby dumpsters reeked, and he could hear the central heating units on top of the auditorium rumbling away. It was that period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, the fall semester drawing to a close, the smell of dead leaves in the air, and the quiet that befalls a campus in advance of exam week. His ride, a black Suburban, was parked in the alley. Arnold Pope, bundled up in a North Face jacket, sat on the hood, reading a book in the light of a street lamp. David walked over.
"How'd it go?" Arnold asked.
It's over. This tour's over, and that's a good thing.
You're already done signing?
I'm skipping out. Small present to myself.
Congratulations. Let's get you back downtown.
Arnold closed the paperback. Not just yet. I want to take a little walk across campus first. If they come asking for me.
Never saw you. Good man.
David patted his arm and headed off down the alleyway. Pope had been with him now for 4 years, initially on the payroll as a driver, but with his law enforcement background, David had let him branch out into PI work. The man was talented, capable, and scary. David had come to value not only Pope's investigative acumen, but also his counsel. Pope was fast becoming his right-hand man. Crossing Sheridan, he soon found himself walking into an open field. Despite the late hour, the stained glass windows of the library glowed. The sky was clear, the moon climbing over the spires of large Gothic hall in the distance. He'd left his coat in the Suburban, and the cold wind cut through his wool jacket, coming off the lake that was less than a quarter of a mile away. But it felt good. He felt good. Alive. Halfway across Deering Meadow, he caught the scent of cigarette smoke riding on the breeze. 2 steps later, he nearly tripped over her, caught himself, staggered back, saw the tobacco ember first, and then, as his eyes adjusted in the growing moonlight, the girl behind it. "Sorry," he said, "I didn't see you there." She looked up at him, her knees drawn into her chest. Dragging deeply on the cigarette, the ember flaring and fading, flaring and fading. Even in the poor light, he could see she wasn't a student here. David knelt down. She cut her eyes up at him. She was shivering. The backpack in the grass beside her was packed to the gills. "Are you okay?" he asked. "Yeah." "What are you doing out here?" "How the fuck is that any of your business?" she smoked. "Are you like a professor here?" "No." "What are you doing out here in the dark and the cold?" "I don't know. Just needed to get away from people for a minute. Clear my head." "I know the feeling," she said. As the moon cleared the spires of the hall behind them, its light brightened the girl's face. Her left eye was black, swollen, half closed. "Someone hit you," he said. He looked at her backpack again. "You on your own?" "Of course not. I won't turn you in." She smoked her cigarette down to her fingers. Flicking it into the grass, she pulled another one out of her pocket, fired it up. "That's really bad for you, you know," David said. She shrugged. "What's the worst that'll happen?"
"You could die."
"Yeah, that'd be so tragic." "How old are you?" "How old are you?"
57.
David reached into his pocket, found his wallet, took out all the cash he had. "This is a little over $200. I'm not going to blow you."
"No, I'm not.
I just want you to have this."
"Seriously?"
"Yeah." Her hands were shaking with cold as she took the wad of cash.
"You'll get yourself a warm bed tonight?" David asked.
"Yeah, because hotels rent out rooms to 14-year-olds all the damn time."
"It's freezing out here," she smirked, a glint of spirit in her eyes.
"I have my methods. I won't die tonight, don't worry. But I will get a hot meal. Thank you."
David stood.
"How long have you been on your own?" he asked.
4 months.
"Winter's coming. I would rather freeze to death than go back to another foster home. You wouldn't understand. I grew up in this beautiful neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut. Cute little town just a 40-minute train ride from Grand Central Station. Picket fences, kids playing in the streets. It was the 1950s. You probably don't know who Norman Rockwell is, but it's the kind of place he would have painted. When I was 7 years old, my parents left me with the sitter one Friday evening. They were going to drive into the city to have dinner and see a show. They never came back."
"They left you?"
"They were killed in a car wreck."
"Oh." Never assume you know where someone else is coming from.
He walked away, pant legs swishing through the grass. She called out after him.
I'll be gone by the time you tell the cops you saw me.
I'm not telling the cops, David said. After 10 more steps, he stopped. He glanced back. Then he walked back, knelt down in front of her again.
I knew you were a fucking pervert, she said.
No, I'm a scientist.
Listen, I could give you real work. A warm place to stay, safety from the streets, the cops, your parents, child services, whatever it is you're running from.
Fuck off!
I'm staying downtown at the Drake Hotel. My last name is Pilcher. I'll already have your very own room waiting for you if you change your mind.
I wouldn't wait up.
He stood. Take care of yourself. I'm David, by the way.
Have a nice life, David.
What's your name?
What do you care?
I honestly don't know.
She rolled her eyes, blew out a stream of smoke.
Pamela, she said. Pam.
David slipped quietly into his suit and hung his coat on the rack beside the door. Elizabeth was sitting in the parlor, reading in the soft light of a floor lamp that overhung the leather chair beside the window. She was 42 years old. Her short blonde hair had begun to lose its vibrancy, yellow considering silver. A stunning winter beauty.
How'd it go? She asked.
He leaned down and kissed her. It went great.
So this means you're done?
We're done. We're going home.
You mean to the mountain?
That is home now, my love. David walked over to the window and swept aside the heavy drapes. There was no view of the city, just the lights of late traffic on Lakeshore Drive and the black chasm of the lake beyond, yawning out into darkness. He crossed the suite and carefully opened the door to the bedroom, crept inside. His footfalls soundless on the thick carpeting. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the darkness. Then he saw her, curled up in a ball on the immense bed. She had kicked away the blankets and rolled over to the edge. He moved her back into the center of the mattress and covered her again and eased her head gently onto a pillow. His little girl took a deep breath, but didn't wake. Leaning over, he kissed her on the cheek and whispered, "Sweet dreams, my sweet Alyssa." When he opened the bedroom door, his wife was standing there.
"What's wrong, Elizabeth?"
"We just had a knock at the door."
"Who was it?"
"A teenage girl. She said her name is Pam, that you told her to come here. She's waiting out in the hallway for you."
Part 2. Chapter 8. Tobias finished tying off his bivy sack and descended the pine tree. In the failing light, he huddled over the circle of rocks and kindling with his flint and steel, building the nerve. It was a risk, always a risk, but it had been weeks since he'd felt the glow of a fire, since he'd steeped pine needles in a pot of boiling water and let something warm run down his throat. He had thoroughly scouted the area. No footprints, no scat. Nothing to indicate it was frequented by anything other than a doe and two fawns. He'd seen a tuft of coarse white hair caught in the thorns of a raspberry bush. He struck a spark onto the charcloth. A yellow flame licked up and impaled a bundle of old man's beard that was laced with a dismembered branch of dead fir. The spikes of dried-out, russet-colored needles ignited. Smoke coiled out of the tinder. His heart swelled with primal joy. Tobias built up a cone of sticks over the growing flames and held his hands to the heat. He hadn't bathed since his last river crossing. That had been at least a month ago. He still remembered catching his reflection in the grass-smooth current, beard down to his sternum, skin embedded with dirt. He looked like a caveman. Tobias added a single log to the blaze and leaned back against the tree. He felt reasonably safe in this little grove of pines, but there was no sense in pushing the luck he'd already pushed so many times to the breaking point.
At the bottom of his Kelty backpack, he pulled out the 1 liter titanium camp kettle and filled it halfway with water from his last remaining bottle, dropped in a handful of sharp-smelling pine needles fresh off the branch. Kicked back, waiting for his tea to boil, was as close to human as he'd felt in ages. He drank the pot of tea and let the fire die. Before he lost its light completely, he took inventory of the contents of his pack. 6 1-liter water bottles, only half of one still full, flint and steel, a first aid kit down to a single pill of Advil, a dry bag filled with buffalo jerky, pipe, book of matches, and the last of his tobacco, which he was holding on to for his final night, if it ever came, in the wilderness. His last box of 30-30 Winchester cartridges, a .357 Smith & Wesson revolver for which he'd run out of ammo over a year ago, pack fly, a leather-bound journal sealed in plastic. He pulled out a stick of jerky and scraped off the carpeting of mold, allowed himself 5 small bites before returning it to the bag. He finished off the pine tea and packed everything back. Shouldering the pack, he climbed 20 feet to his perch in the tree and fastened the Kelty to a branch. He untied his hiking boots, the soles long since worn through the tread and the leather beginning to disintegrate, and laced them to the tree. He slid his arms out of his barber duster. The coat was months overdue for a thorough waxing, but so far it kept him dry. He maneuvered into the bivy sack and zipped himself in. Wow, he stunk. It was almost like he'd developed his own musk. His mind wouldn't stop running. The chances of a swarm stumbling through this grove of pines were admittedly slim. A small group or a loner, better. Tree bivouacking was a good news, bad news proposition. The good news? It kept him out of the obvious lines of sight. Countless times he'd heard a branch snap in the middle of the night and rolled quietly over to stare down 20 or 30 feet at an abbey creeping past underneath him. The bad news? If one ever looked up, he was treed. He reached down and touched the smooth, leathered handle of his bowie. It was the only real weapon in his arsenal. The Winchester would get him killed in close combat, and he only used it anymore to hunt his food. He slept always with his hand on the knife, sometimes waking in the dark, other side of midnight to find himself clutching it like a talisman. Strange to think that an object of such violence had assumed a place as comforting in his mind as the memory of his mother's voice. Then he was awake. He could see the sky through the branches above him. His breath steamed in the cold. It was absolutely quiet, save for the slow bump, bump, bump of his heart beating in the pre-dawn. He craned his neck, stared down at the remains of his campfire. White smoke trickled up out of the embers. Tobias wiped the dew off the long barrel of his high-powered rifle and shouldered his Kelty. He walked to the edge of the grove and crouched down between a pair of saplings. It was damn cold. First freeze of the season couldn't be more than a night or two away. He took a compass out of his pocket. He was facing east. A series of meadows and forests gradually climbed toward a range of mountains in the far distance, 50, possibly 60 miles away. He didn't know with any certainty, but he held out hope that they were what had once been called the Sawtooth. If they were, he was almost home. Raising his rifle to his shoulder, he stared through the telescopic sight and glassed the terrain ahead. There was no breeze. The weeds in the open fields stood motionless. 2 miles out, he spotted bison, a cow and her calf grazing. The next stretch of forest looked to be 3 or 4 miles away. Long time to be in the open. He slung the rifle over his shoulder and walked away from the protection of the trees. 200 yards out, he glanced back at the grove of pines dwindling behind him. It had been a good night there. Fire and tea and the closest thing to a restful night's sleep he could ever hope to experience in the wild. He walked into the sun, stronger than he'd felt in days. Between his black beard, black cowboy hat, and black duster that fell to his ankles, he looked like a vagabond prophet sent to roam the world, and in some ways, perhaps he was. He hadn't made the notation in his journal yet, but this was day 1,287 of his trek. He'd made it as far west as the Pacific and as far north as where the great port city of Seattle had once stood. He'd nearly been killed a dozen times, had killed 44 Abbeys, 39 with a revolver, 3 with his Bowie knife, 2 in hand-to-hand combat that he had come very close to losing. And now, he just needed to get home. Not only for the warm bed that awaited him and the promise of sleep without the ever-present threat of death, not just for the food and the long-dreamt-of sex with the woman he loved, but because he had some news to report. My God, did he have some news.
Chapter 9. Ethan followed Marcus down the Level 2 corridor past a series of doors labeled Lab A, Lab B, Lab C. Near the far end, within spitting distance of the stairwell, Ethan's escort stopped at a door inset with a circle of glass. Marcus pulled out his keycard.
"I don't know how long I'm going to be," Ethan said, "but I'll have them notify you when I'm ready to go back to town."
"It's not a problem. I'll be by your side the whole time."
"No, you won't."
"Sheriff, my orders, go cry to your boss. You may be my driver, but you aren't my shadow. Not anymore. And while you're at it, wrangle up Alyssa's reports on her mission."
Ethan snatched the young man's keycard, swiped it through the reader, and shoved it back into his chest. Stepping across the threshold, he turned and stared the escort down as he shut the door in his face. The room wasn't dark, but it was dim, like a theater 5 minutes before the movie starts. A 5x5 stack of monitors glowed on the wall straight ahead. There was another door to the right of the screens that was accessed by a keycard entry. Ethan had never been granted access to surveillance. A man wearing a headset turned in his swivel chair.
"I was told you could help me," Ethan said.
The man stood, short-sleeved, button-down, adorned with a clip-on tie, balding, mustached, what appeared to be a coffee stain on his lapel. He looked like he belonged in mission control, and the room certainly emanated a nerve-center vibe. Ethan closed the distance between them, but he didn't offer his hand. Said, "I'm sure you know plenty about me, but I'm afraid I don't even know your name."
"I'm Ted. I head up the surveillance group."
Ethan had tried to prepare himself for this moment, for meeting Pilcher's number 3, the man tasked with spying on the people of Wayward Pines in their most private moments. The urge to break his nose was even stronger than Ethan had anticipated. "Have you watched Teresa and me together?"
"You're investigating Alyssa's murder?" Ted asked.
"That's right."
"She was a great woman. I want to do whatever I can to help."
"Glad to hear that. Please, have a seat." Ethan followed Ted over to the monitors. They sat down in swivel chairs on wheels. The control panel looked ready-made to fly an alien spacecraft. Multiple keyboards and touchscreen technology that looked more advanced than anything Ethan remembered from his world.
"Before we start," Ethan said, "I want to ask you something."
"Sure."
"All you do is sit in here and eavesdrop on private lives, correct?" Ted's eyes seemed to cloud.
"Was that shame?"
"That is my life."
"Were you aware of Alyssa's mission in town?"
"I was."
"Okay. So here's my question. You're in command of the most sophisticated surveillance system I've ever seen. How did you miss her murder?"
"We don't catch everything here, Mr. Burke. There are thousands of cameras in town, but most of them are indoors. We had a far more extensive exterior network when Pines began 14 years ago, but the elements have exacted considerable damage. They've killed cameras, drastically limited our eyesight."
"So whatever happened to Alyssa
occurred in a blind spot, yes."
"These blind spots, do you know where they are?"
Ted turned his attention to the controls, his fingers moving at light speed across an array of touchscreens. The camera feeds vanished. 25 monitors now merged into a single image, an aerial photograph of Wayward Pines. Ted said,
"So we're looking at the town and the valley. Pretty much every square foot of real estate inside the boundary of the electrified fence. We can push in anywhere we want."
The image zoomed down into the school, the playground equipment crystallizing into sharp focus.
"Is this real time?" Ethan asked.
No, this photo was taken years ago, but it's the grid upon which all of our tracking relies.
Ted tapped the screen at his fingertips. A day-glow overlay appeared. Most of the town was covered. Ted pointed at the screens.
Everywhere you see this overlay, we have a current, real-time, microchip-triggered camera feed. But you'll notice black spots, even within the coverage.
He tapped his controls, and a single house filled the screen. The overhead perspective changed to a three-dimensional, street-level view. With a swipe of his finger, the Victorian's windows and wood siding stripped away, and the image became an interactive blueprint.
You'll note that there are three blind spots in this residence. However, the day-glow overlay was replaced with solid red. There are no what we call death spots. This house, like every other residence in town, is sufficiently mic'd to capture anything above 30 decibels.
How loud is 30 decibels?
Ted whispered, "A library conversation."
He returned the screens to the aerial image of Pines with the day-glow overlay.
So aside from a few blind spots in each house, most of indoor Pines is thoroughly wired. But once you get outside, even in town, the system begins to show cracks in its veneer. Look at all the black areas. There's a backyard with no visual surveillance whatsoever. The cemetery is a disaster, just a few cameras here and there. And as you move away from the center of Pines and follow the cliffs, it only gets worse. Look at these blind spots on the south side. 20-acre stretches of completely unmonitored terrain. Now, in theory, we have a way to handle that.
Ted punched in something on a keyboard. A new overlay meshed with the day glow. Hundreds of red blips appeared. The vast majority clustered in a 6-block radius near the center of town. Some were moving.
Recognize those? Ted asked.
The microchips.
We're reading 460 signals, one short.
That's because I'm sitting here with you.
Correct.
Ted moved the cursor over a stationary blip in a building on Main Street. He tapped the touch screen. A text bubble blossomed. Ethan read, "Brad Fisher.
I believe you had dinner with Brad and his wife last night. It's 10:11 a.m. and Mr. Fisher is in his law office, right where he's supposed to be. Of course, all this data can be massaged any number of ways."
Every blip disappeared except for Fisher's. The timestamp at the bottom of the screen began to run backward. His blip moved out of the building, north up Main Street, and into his house.
"How far back can you go?" Ethan asked. "All the way to Mr. Fisher's integration."
The red dot raced all over town, months rewinding. Years.
"And I can give him a trail," Ted said.
A trail appeared and scribbled everywhere like someone pushing a stylus across the screen.
"Impressive," Ethan said. "Of course, you understand our problem."
"System works until people cut out their microchips."
"It's not an easy or painless procedure. Of course you know that."
"So what exactly do you do all day?" Ethan asked.
"You mean how does one go about monitoring an entire town?"
"Yeah."
"Put on that headset."
Ethan grabbed it off the console.
"Can you hear me?"
Ted's voice came loud and clear through the speakers.
"Yep."
Ted's fingers worked the touchscreen, and the image of Wayward Pines and Brad Fisher's lifelong trajectory switched back to 25 separate images.
"I'm one of the three real-time surveillance techs," Ted said. "Through that door over there, we have 4 more surveillance techs reviewing flagged footage and audio round the clock. Tracking persons of interest, generating reports, communicating with our in-town team, with you. Do you understand how the system gathers and sorts data?"
"No."
"I'm not saying video isn't crucial, but it's really the audio that we lean most heavily on. Our system runs state-of-the-art voice recognition software, which pings off certain words, tones of voice. We're not looking as closely at the actual words as the emotions behind them. We also have body language recognition, but it's less effective."
"Care to demonstrate?"
"Sure, bear with me. It'll be disorienting at first."
The screens began to change. Ethan saw a woman washing dishes. A schoolroom with Megan Fisher pointing at a blackboard. The Riverside Park, empty. A man sitting in a chair in a house staring into nothing. A man and woman fucking in a shower.
It went on like this. Images coming faster and faster. Snippets of audio. Pieces of conversation meaningless and out of context, like a child turning through stations on a radio dial.
You catch that? Ted asked.
No, what?
The images froze. One of them filled the screens. The view looked down from a ceiling at a woman leaning against a refrigerator, her crossed arms outlined in dayglow.
There, Ted said. That's a defensive posture. See the recognition overlay?
A man stood in front of her, his face out of view.
Let's see if we can't capture a better angle. Three different camera views of the kitchen streamed past too quickly for Ethan to process any of it.
Nope, that's as good as it gets.
Ethan watched Ted's right hand raise a digital volume bar. The eavesdropping upon conversation became prominent in his headset. The woman said,
But I saw you with her.
The man said, When?
Yesterday. You guys were sitting at the same table in the library.
We're friends, Donna, that's all.
How do I know it's not more than that?
Because you trust me?
Because I love you and would never do anything to hurt you?
Ted killed the volume.
Okay, I remember this couple. He is actually cheating on her. He's done it with at least four women I can think of. Real scumbag.
So you won't continue to monitor this?
No, we will.
He typed as he talked. I'm flagging this camera feed right now. Later today, one of my techs will scan Mr. Cheater's footage from the last week or so. Confirm none of his trysts are getting out of control. Mr. Pilcher and Pam will have surveillance reports on their desks first thing tomorrow.
And then?
They'll take whatever action they deem necessary.
You mean they'll stop him from doing this?
If his behavior is seen as a threat to the general peace, absolutely.
What will they do to him?
Ted looked up from the controls and smiled.
You mean, what will you do?
All likelihood, you'll be the one to handle it, Sheriff Burke.
Ted reset the screens to the single aerial view of Wayward Pines.
Now that you have a basic understanding of how our system works and its capabilities, I'm at your disposal. What do you want to see?
Ethan leaned back in his chair.
Can you pull up Alyssa's tracking chip?
A red blip appeared in a house at the east end of town. Ted said,
Obviously that's not her. The night of her death, Alyssa removed her microchip and left it in her bedside table drawer.
I didn't even know Pilcher had a daughter.
How's he holding up?
To be honest, I don't know. David's a complicated man. Values above all control of his emotions. He's grieving privately, I'm sure.
Where's Alyssa's mother?
Not here. Ted said in a tone that discouraged further inquiry.
All right, let me see her movement around town going back 1 week.
Ted worked at the controls. The blip went from the house to the community gardens and back. Then it moved out of the house and off the map.
Was that when she was last inside the mountain? Ethan asked.
Yes.
Alyssa's microchip moved back into town, up and down Main Street, the community gardens, then home again.
Ethan stood up from his chair and stretched his arms over his head.
Can you pull another microchip? Ethan asked.
Sure, whose?
Kate Hewson's?
You mean Kate Ballinger.
Ted keyed in her name and tapped a panel with his right hand. A second blip materialized in another part of town. Ethan asked,
Is it possible for you to isolate all instances where these two dots were in the same place at the same time?
Now you're talking. How far back?
Same date range, starting 1 week ago?
Ethan watched Ted input the parameters into a data field. When he looked back at the screens, there were four paired blips on the aerial map.
Can you pull the video and audio feed from each encounter? Thought you'd never ask.
Ted exploded the first of two pairs of dots in the community gardens.
This was the first encounter, he said. Happened 6 days ago. Give me a second. Let me find the best angle.
He cruised through a number of vantage points, far too fast for Ethan to comprehend anything.
Okay, here's our winner.
Kate filled the screen. She wore a summer dress, sunglasses, a straw hat. She strolled toward the camera between rows of raised flower beds. A woven basket dangled from one arm, bulging with vegetables and fruit. The back of someone's head filled the lower part of the screen.
Is that Alyssa? Ethan asked.
Yes.
Ted upped the volume.
Kate,
No more apples?
Alyssa.
No, they went fast.
Kate reached into her basket and handed something to Alyssa.
Freeze it, Ethan said.
The image held, Kate's arm outstretched.
What is that? Ethan asked.
A green apple?
Ted rolled video.
Kate,
you're always bringing the loveliest fruits and veggies to us. I thought I'd bring you something from my garden.
Alyssa.
What a gorgeous pepper.
Kate.
Thank you.
Alyssa.
I'll have this tonight.
Kate moved out of frame.
Want to see it again? Ted asked.
No, play the next one. They watched Kate and Alyssa rendezvous three more times. Next day on Main Street, the women passed each other and Alyssa shook her head. The day after, at the Riverside Park, their paths crossed again. This time, Alyssa nodded.
Wonder what that's all about, Ted said.
He glanced at Ethan.
Any ideas?
Not yet. Ted played Alyssa and Kate's last encounter. It happened the day of Alyssa's death at the community gardens, and the interaction was identical to their first. Kate stopped at Alyssa's vegetable stand, the exchange of a few words. Then Kate handed her another bell pepper. Ted paused the video. Ethan said,
There's probably a note in that pepper. That says what?
I don't know. Meeting place and time? Instructions for Alyssa to remove her microchip?
Explain something to me. I understand that when these wanderers remove their chips, you can't track them. But don't the cameras still pick up their movement?
No.
No?
Our cameras only key off microchip proximity and motion.
What does that mean exactly?
Look, there's no way to monitor this town using the thousands of cameras all running at once. Most of the time, we'd just be scrolling through empty space. So our cameras key off the microchips. In other words, until a chip moves within range of a sensor, the camera is in sleep mode. It only transmits a video feed when a microchip pings it. And even then, when a chip is motionless for 15 seconds, the camera reverts to sleep mode.
So what you're saying is,
the cameras don't run all the time. When a resident removes their microchip, for all intents and purposes, they become a ghost. Somehow, these wanderers have figured out a way to game the system.
Show me.
Ted brought up a new image. Here's the last 30 seconds we have of Kate on the night Alyssa was murdered.
On the screens, a bedroom appeared.
Kate entered the room wearing a nightgown that fell to her knees. Her husband followed. They climbed into bed together, killed the lights. The overhead camera switched to night vision. The Ballingers lay absolutely still in bed. After 15 seconds, the feed went dark. Next time it picked up, morning light filled the room and both Kate and her husband were sitting up in bed.
Reinserting their chips, Ethan said.
Yes, but all night, from approximately 10:15 until 7:30 the next morning, they were ghosts. And in that period of time, Alyssa Pilcher lost her life.
This is why Pilcher really runs the fates, isn't it?
Ethan looked at Ted.
Am I right? It's not only because he wants the town to police itself. It's because when someone removes their chip, he actually needs our help to find them.
Ethan called for Marcus. When his escort arrived, Ethan said, I want to see Alyssa's quarters. They climbed the stairwell, 2 flights to level 4. 5 steps into the corridor, Ethan knew which doorway opened into Alyssa's room by the bunches of fresh flowers scattered across the floor. He wondered if Pilcher had sent someone into town for them. All around the door frame, the wall had been papered with notes, cards, photographs, banners. Whoever and whatever else Alyssa had been, at least inside this mountain, she was a loved woman.
Sir, the escort said, I got those reports you asked for.
Marcus handed Ethan a manila folder.
I'd like to go inside, Ethan said.
Of course. Marcus took out his key card and swiped it through the scanner. Ethan turned the doorknob, walked inside. It was a tight living space. Windowless. No more than 100 square feet. A single bed had been positioned against the far wall. There was a desk, a chest of drawers, a wall of bookshelves, half of which held books, the other half framed photographs. Ethan studied them,
the photos all of the same woman at varying ages, young girl to 50-year-old woman. Alyssa's mother? Ethan sat down on Alyssa's bed. The wall across the bookshelves was a masterful mural of a beach, palm trees, green water over dark reefs, white sand, a sky that went on forever. Ethan leaned back into the pillows, kicked his boots up on the bed. Smiled. From this angle, when you stared at the mural, it felt like you were there, reclining in the sand, staring off into that false line on the horizon where the sea touched the sky. The folder was entitled Mission Number 1055 Contact Log. He opened it. 5 pages. 5 reports. Day number 5293, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 1, subject, resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. First contact made at approximately 11:25 at the corner of Main and 9th. Note slipped to Kate Ballinger that read, sick of being watched. Brief eye contact made, no words spoken. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5311, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 2. Subject, resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. 18 days post-initial contact, Ballinger approached me at the gardens and gave me a bell pepper. The pepper had been sliced open, and there was a note inside that read, tracking chip on hamstring in your left leg. Cut it out in a closet, but keep with you until further notice. 2 potential rendezvous times were given for me to confirm I had removed the chip. The first at 1400 on day 5312, the next at 1500 on day 5313. If I failed to remove the chip by day 5313, we would have no further interaction. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5312. From Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055. Contact report number 3. Subject, resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. At 1400, I passed Ballinger walking south on Main Street near the intersection of 6th. I shook my head. No further contact was made on this date. Day 5313, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 4. Subject, resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. At 1500, I passed Ballinger walking south on the Riverside Trail. I nodded to her. She smiled. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5314, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 5. Subject, resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. Ballinger returned to my stand at the gardens with a second bell pepper. The note inside read, tonight, 1 a.m., the cemetery mausoleum. Leave your chip in your bedside table. Wear a jacket with a hood. We'll follow up with a new report tomorrow. Ethan moved through the level 3 corridor with his escort in tow. Halfway down, he stopped at a pair of double doors. Through the glass, he saw a full-court basketball game in progress, shirts versus skins, the impact of the ball on the hard wood, the squeak of shoes. For a millisecond, he had the mad thought of joining in the game. They walked on. "Mind if I ask you something, Marcus?"
"Shoot."
"How old are you?"
27.
"And how long have you lived here in the superstructure?"
"Mr. Pilcher brought me out of suspension 2 years ago to replace a guard who was killed on a mission out beyond the fence."
"Everyone in the mountain knew what they were getting themselves into when they signed on with Pilcher, correct?"
"That's right."
"So why'd you do it?"
"Do what?"
Ethan stopped outside the doors to a cafeteria. He faced Marcus. "Why'd you throw your old life away for this?"
"I didn't throw anything away, Mr. Burke. In my life before, you know what I was."
"What?"
"A tweaker and a drunk."
"And what, Pilcher found you?
gave you a chance to be all you could be?
I met him just out of prison, a 3-year stint for vehicular manslaughter. I was high and drunk and killed a family on New Year's Eve. He saw something in me I never knew was there.
Didn't you have a family, friends? A life that was at least your own? What made you trust him in the first place?
I don't know. But he was right, wasn't he? We're a part of something here, Mr. Burke. Something that matters. All of us.
Here's the thing, Marcus, and I don't want you to ever forget it. Nobody fucking asked me, or anyone in that valley, if we wanted to be a part of this. Ethan walked on. At the bottom of the stairwell leading out into level 1, a noise stopped him. Marcus was already swiping his card at the glass door entrance to the cavern. Ethan started down the corridor.
Mr. Burke, where are you going?
The noise was something screaming. Banshee-like. Tortured. Inhuman. He'd heard it before, and it chilled him to his core.
Mr. Burke!
Ethan was jogging down the corridor now, the screams getting louder.
Mr. Burke!
He stopped at a wide window, stared through the plate glass into a laboratory. There were 2 men in white coats and David Pilcher. They surrounded an aberration. The creature had been strapped to a steel gurney. Stout leather restraints buckled down across its legs, below its knees and above. One across its torso, another across its shoulders, a fifth securing its head. Its thick wrists and ankles had been clamped down to the sides of the gurney with heavy-gauge steel bracelets, and the thing convulsed against the leather straps as if in the throes of electrocution.
"You shouldn't be here," Marcus said, sidling up to Ethan.
"What are they doing to it?"
"Come on, let's go. Mr. Pilcher won't be happy if he sees..."
Ethan pounded on the glass. Marcus said, "Oh, geez." The men turned, the 2 scientists scowling. Pilcher said something to them and then walked over to the lab entrance. When the door opened, the Abbey's screams amplified, echoing up and down the corridor like something calling out from hell. The doors whisked closed.
"Ethan, how can I help you?"
"I was on my way out. I heard screams." Pilcher turned toward the plate glass. The Abbey had calmed down or worn itself out. Only its head swiveled under the strap, its screams reduced to croaks. Ethan could see its massive heart beating furiously through its translucent skin. There was no detail, only color and form and motion, all obscured as if behind frosted glass.
"Quite a specimen, no?" Pilcher said. "He's a 317-pound bull, one of the largest males we've ever seen. You'd think he'd be alpha male of a sizable swarm, but my sniper spotted him coming down the canyon this morning all by his lonesome. Took 400 milligrams of telazol to bring him down. That's the full-grown male adult jaguar dosage, and he was still only sluggish by the time we reached him."
"How long did that keep him sedated?"
"These tranks only work for about 3 hours. After that, you better have them locked up, because boy, do they come back angry."
"He's a big boy."
"Bigger than the one you tangled with, for sure. I think it's fair to say if you'd met this bull in the canyon, we wouldn't be speaking right now."
"What are you doing with it?"
"Getting ready to remove a gland at the base of its neck."
"Why?"
"Abbeys communicate through pheromones. These are airborne signals that give information and trigger responses."
"Don't humans do the same thing?"
"Yeah, but it's at a much more instinctual, broader level for us. Sexual attraction, mother-infant recognition. Abbeys use pheromones like we use words."
"So why are you effectively cutting out that thing's tongue?"
"Because the last thing we want is for him to tell all his friends he's in trouble. Don't get me wrong. I love the fence. I trust the fence. But several hundred abbeys on the other side trying to figure out how to save their brother makes me a little uncomfortable."
Pilcher glanced down at Ethan's waist.
"You still aren't wearing a revolver."
"I'm here, in the mountain. What does it matter?"
"It matters, Ethan, because I asked you to do it. It's a simple thing, isn't it? Wear a gun at all times. Look the goddamn part."
Ethan stared back through the glass. One of the scientists was leaning over the Abbey's face,
shining a penlight into its left eye as it hissed. It looked to be between 6 and 7 feet tall, arms and legs like cords of intertwined steel fiber. Ethan couldn't take his eyes off the beast, its black talons as long as his fingers.
"Are they intelligent?" Ethan asked.
"Oh my, yes. As smart as chimpanzees. Their brains are larger than ours. Because of obvious communication barriers, testing their intelligence on our terms becomes problematic. I've attempted a battery of social and physical tests, and it's not that they can't do them. They just refuse. It would be like me trying to test you and you telling me to stick it up my ass sideways. That sort of a response. We did capture a somewhat compliant specimen several months ago. She's down in cage 9. Low hostility rating. We call her Margaret.
How low?
I gave her recall tests, sitting across a table from her in her cage. Now, I did have 2 guards behind me pointing shotguns loaded with 12-gauge slugs at her chest, but still, she displayed no signs of aggression.
How'd you test her?
With a simple child's memory game. Walk with me. Pilcher knocked on the glass and held up 1 finger to the scientists. They moved down the corridor toward the glass doors at the far end, Marcus trailing 10 feet behind. I use small cardboard tiles. One side is blank. The other has a photograph, a frog, a bicycle, a glass of milk. I arrange them all picture side up on the table and then let Margaret see them. We start easy, 5 tiles, then 10. She gets 2 minutes to study them. Then I turn them over so she can't see the picture. I reach into a bag containing duplicates of the tiles. I show her, for instance, the one with the glass of milk. She touches her talon to the corresponding tile on the table, and I turn it over to see if she got it right.
How'd she do?
Ethan, we worked our way up to 120 tiles, with Margaret only getting 30 seconds to memorize their positions.
And she got them all right?
Pilcher nodded, pride in his voice.
Total recall.
He stopped and pointed at a small window in a door whose only point of access appeared to be a keycard entry.
I keep her in here. Would you like to meet Margaret?
Not even a little bit. There was a glare off the glass from the overhead fluorescent lights. Ethan cupped his hands around his face and stared into the cage.
I know what you're thinking, Pilcher said, but I don't believe she's an anomaly. Her intelligence, I mean. She's only different in temperament, which is not to say that she wouldn't tear my throat out if she thought she could get away with it.
The cage was only floor, walls, ceiling, monster. The thing called Margaret sat in the corner with its legs curled into its chest. It watched the window and the door through small, opaque eyes that never blinked.
I've already taught her 52 signs. She's a natural learner. Wants to communicate. Unfortunately, her larynx is structured differently than ours to the point of making speech, at least in the sense which we understand it, impossible.
The aberration looked almost meditative. It struck Ethan as infinitely more unsettling to see one sitting still and docile.
Pilcher said, I don't know if you saw my report this morning.
No, I came straight here.
We're bringing a prospective resident out of suspension. Wayne Johnson. It's his first day. He's probably waking up in the hospital as we speak. Pam's handling orientation. We'll see how it goes, but you may be called upon to assist in the coming days.
Okay.
I hope Ted in surveillance was helpful.
He was.
So you'll be reaching out to your old partner soon?
Tonight or tomorrow.
Excellent. You have a game plan?
Working on it.
You will report to me every day on your progress.
Ethan said, David, about your phone call last night.
Forget it. I just thought you should know.
I wanted to tell you again how sorry I am for your loss. If you need anything...
Pilcher stared at Ethan, his eyes raging but his voice cool.
Find who did this to my little girl. That's all I need from you. Nothing more.
Chapter 10 Pam was sitting on the end of the bed in her classic nurse's uniform when Wayne Johnson woke up. For a long time, he lay motionless under the comforter, blinking at the ceiling. Finally, he sat up and looked at her. He was shirtless, balding, 42 years old, never married, no children. Wayne had come to Wayward Pines, Idaho on August 8, 1992, as a traveling encyclopedia salesman. He'd arrived late and knocked on five doors. In the evening, after one sale, he checked into the Wayward Pines Hotel and then walked to a family-style restaurant. En route, he was struck by a motorcycle in the crosswalk, a perfect hit and run, enough head trauma to render him unconscious, but not enough to kill or permanently damage his brain. In light of the death of Peter McCall two nights ago at the fence, the town was primed for the introduction of a new resident. Wayne Johnson's skin still looked gray. He was only 10 hours post-suspension blood transfusion, but his color would be back by day's end. Pam smiled and said, "Hello there." He squinted at her, his vision probably still blurred as his system rebooted. His eyes darted around the room. They were on the fourth floor of the hospital. The window was cracked, and the white linen curtains pushed in and out as the breeze ebbed and flowed, the rhythm as steady as if the room itself was breathing. Wayne Johnson said, "Where am I?"
"Wayward Pines."
He pulled the covers up around his neck, but it wasn't modesty that drove him.
"I'm freezing."
"Totally normal. You'll feel better by the end of the day, I promise."
"Something happened," the man said.
"Yes, something happened. Do you remember what?" His eyes narrowed. "Do you know your name?" Pam asked. Total amnesia, especially during the first 48 hours, occurred 39% of the time.
"Wayne Johnson."
"Very good. Do you remember what brought you here?"
"I came to sell encyclopedias."
"Yes, good. Did you make any sales?"
"I don't re- one, I think. Yes, one sale."
"And then what happened?"
"I was walking to dinner and..."
She could see the memory of the trauma wash over him, the fear and the shadow of the fear passing across his face.
"Something hit me. I don't know what. I don't remember anything after..." "Is this a hospital?"
"Yes, and this is your town now."
"My town?"
"That's right."
"I don't live here. I live in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska."
"You did live in Scotts Bluff, but now you live here." Wayne sat up a little straighter.
This was by far and away Pam's favorite part of integration, watching a new resident begin to comprehend that their life, or whatever this new existence was, had irrevocably changed. Nothing beat the fates, but these moments of quiet, devastating revelation were, at least for her, a close second. "What does that mean exactly?" Wayne Johnson asked.
"It means that you live here now." Sometimes they connected the dots on their own. Sometimes she had to nudge them over the line. She waited a minute, watching the wheels turn frantically behind Mr. Johnson's eyes. He finally said,
"In the accident, was I hurt?"
Pam reached across the bed and patted the lump that was his leg under the blankets.
"I'm afraid you were."
"Hurt bad?" She nodded. "Was I..."
He looked around the hospital room. He looked at his hands. She could feel the question coming. Willed it to come. He was tiptoeing right up to the edge of it.
"Was I..."
Pam thinking, "Ask it, just ask it." The data was conclusive. Almost every time a resident arrived at the question on their own and found the coverage to give voice to it, their integration progressed without incident. Failing to ask the question was a frighteningly accurate prediction for unbelievers, fighters, runners. Wayne closed his mouth, swallowed the question down like a bitter pill. Pam didn't push it, no point in that. It was still early. Still plenty of time to make Mr. Johnson think that he was dead.
Chapter 11. Ethan sat at a window table in the steaming bean, sipping a cappuccino and watching the toy store across the street. It was called Wooden Treasures, and it adjoined a workshop where a man named Harold Ballinger spent his weekdays building toys. His wife, Kate Ballinger, formerly Kate Hewson, formerly Ethan's partner in the Secret Service, worked in the toy store. Ethan had only spoken to her once since coming to Wayward Pines, in the midst of his horrifying integration. But since becoming sheriff, they hadn't said two words to each other, and he'd managed to avoid her entirely. Now he studied her through the glass. She sat at the cash register in the empty toy store, engrossed in a book. It was late afternoon, and the light angling through the storefront glass fired her prematurely white hair into a shock of almost blinding brilliance, like a cumulus cloud backlit by sunlight. He'd read her resident file, read it several times. Kate had lived in Wayward Pines for almost 9 years. When he'd come looking for her, she'd been 36. She would turn 45 in 3 weeks. In their life before, he'd been a year older. Now she had him by 8. Her file told of a brutal integration. She'd fought, tried to escape, pushed Pilcher's patience right up to the brink of ordering a fate. Then, she'd simply relented. Settled into her assigned house, settled into her assigned job. And 2 years later, when the word came down from Pilcher's sheriff at the time, she'd married Harold Ballinger and moved in with him without the slightest protestation. For 5 years, they were model residents. The first surveillance report was triggered off an audio strike from the microphone over their bed. A whispered phrase that just squeaked into the delectable decibel range. Kate's voice. The Englers and the Goldens are in. Then nothing for a month until Kate's microchip popped one night at 2 in the morning in the cemetery. Sheriff Pope had tracked her down, found her out wandering alone. He'd questioned her, but she played dumb, made her apologies, lied and said she'd had a fight with Harold, needed to get some fresh air. There had been one last incident 2 days later, Harold and Kate disappearing for an hour inside their bedroom closet, which incidentally happened to be one of the few blind spots in the house. The footage was flagged, a report generated, but nothing came of it. There were no further reports for a year and a half until Ted from surveillance sent a memo to Pilcher and Pam. Ethan read it as he sipped his cappuccino. Day 5129. From Ted Upshaw to David Pilcher. Subjects, residence 308 and 294, a.k.a. Kate and Harold Ballinger. I've harbored a mounting suspicion over the past few months, which I feel compelled to share with you now. After midnight, once every couple of weeks, in 11 households that we know of, Ballinger, Angler, Kirby, Terrell, Smith, Golden, O'Brien, Nyswander, Green, Brandenburg, and Shaw, the interior cameras produce no video feed for extended periods of time, roughly between 4 and 7 hours. A typical night feed is 2 hours of tossing and turning, with all the motionless activity missing. The only thing that could cause such extended video blackouts would be a complete absence of microchip movement. In other words, no motion to ping the cameras. But this is impossible. For a camera to shut off at night for hours at a time, the subjects would have to sleep perfectly still, or be dead. The cameras are highly sensitive and programmed to wake at the slightest movement, even the rise and fall of someone's chest associated with heavy breathing. The cameras have not been disabled. If this was one instance in one household, I might write it off as an anomaly. But the sheer number of extended blackout occurrences, their repetition, and the fact that they're happening concurrently across multiple households leads me to the conclusion that something bigger, covert, and coordinated is taking place behind our backs. I believe the above-named residents, and possibly more, have not only discovered their microchips, but also found a way to remove them at any time in plain view of the cameras. Obviously, without their microchips embedded, residents could move unseen and undetected in their homes, through town, even beyond the fence. The possibility of a growing contingent of residents meeting together in secret is a disturbing development, which I believe requires immediate action.